Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is William T. Volman, author of the new two-volume work, Carbon Ideologies. The first volume, titled No Immediate Danger, is now available, and the second volume, No Good Alternative, goes on sale June 5th. Volman is the author of four collections of short fiction, a memoir, seven works of nonfiction, including the seven-volume treatise on violence, Rising Up and Rising Down, and 10 novels, including the five books currently available in his Seven Dreams series of historical fiction. His journalism and stories have appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's, Esquire, Granta, and many other publications. In the Washington Post review of No Immediate Danger, Mira Sharma writes, "It is overwhelming. It drowns us in calculations, facts, images, stories. It embodies the confusion of our current moment, the insidiousness of disbelief, and the mania-inducing reality that our greatest threat is the hardest to act upon. It is a feverish, sprawling archive of who we are and what we've wrought." Bill Volman, thanks for joining us again on Between the Covers.
Well, thanks for having me again, and it's really nice to see you. You know, after all these years, I feel like you're my friend, and I'm always happy to see you.
I am extremely overjoyed to see you, and I always enjoy talking with you.
Oh, thanks.
Now, Bill, this is our third interview for Between the Covers, and you were kind enough to join us in 2014 for Last Stories and Other Stories, a collection of short fiction, and then again in 2015 for The Dying Grass, which is the fifth book in your Seven Dreams series of historical novels. We ended that interview with a question about your work in progress at the time, this book we're talking about today, Carbon Ideologies, and you made a connection between what you learned about the near extinction of the buffalo while riding The Dying Grass and climate change. You told me, "We feel sad about extinctions, but don't do anything. There's no real urgency." And you were trying to think about the bad choices that we humans are making regarding climate change. You said, "If there are people 100 years from now, I'm guessing they will live in a greatly impoverished, hot, dark, and probably somewhat radioactive world, and they'll be wondering why we did what we did." Bill, Carbon Ideologies is your attempt to answer that question. Why did we do what we did?
You know, Ken, I don't think we have to be too hard on ourselves. 90% of all the species that have ever existed on this planet have gone extinct. And so there's no reason for us to feel bad if we drive ourselves extinct. In my opinion, it's the natural life force, the way a tree always wants to grow taller, a rabbit likes to breed and have lots of little rabbits, and we really want tomorrow to be better than today. Therefore, we increase our demand for a lot of things, and most particularly for energy. I had a chance to interview the retired CEO of Conoco, Mr. Archie Dunham, who I liked very much, and he said, "You know, Bill, there are all these people in the third world, and they want what we want. They want to be able to have a hot shower, and we can't stop them. And who am I to stop them? You know, who am I to start raging and saying, oh, you can't have what I have?" To research this book, I flew all over the place and burned vast quantities of carbon.
That's right. You were truly all over the world for Carbon Ideologies.
I was. And I have a feeling that, you know, if the ideal reader from the future is honest with himself, he's going to say, yeah, I would have done the same.
And of course, you address this book to that ideal reader of the future, or any reader of the future. Much of it is written in past tense, as if you're already long gone, dead and gone, and somebody in the, I don't know, the distant future or the near future, after the world is this hot, dark and possibly radioactive place is reading this work.
It certainly makes it a lot easier for me to imagine that I'm already dead and I don't have to face that horrible stuff.
Right. And we talked about ourselves both being already dead when we talked about last stories and other stories. Now, the two-volume set, Carbon Ideologies, consists of the two books, No Immediate Danger and No Good Alternative. An ideology is a system of ideas, of theories or beliefs, and often used in a political sense. So, for example, capitalism and communism are ideologies. Why did you use the term carbon ideologies rather than something like carbon facts or carbon realities?
Well, you know, there are facts, and as our great president reminds us, there are alternative facts. So which is an alternative fact? That depends on what your ideology is. I have lots of, you know, friends who voted for Trump and don't believe in climate change. They assure me, you know, that the various measurements of sea level rise, the measurements of temperature were all inaccurate, so we have nothing to worry about. You know, over in Japan, the people there are nuclear ideologues. It's not against their interest to believe in climate change. So they can say, yeah, unlike you American slobs, we actually did something about this. You know, we had nuclear power. So we reduced
our carbon footprint, right?
That's right. So, and in West Virginia, people are going to say, well, you know, my great-grandfather was a coal miner. This is a heritage fuel. We've kept the lights on for you guys all over. And now you're telling us that our heritage fuel is no good when God put it on earth for us to use. We're all ideologues.
And you make very clear in the introduction to No Immediate Danger, again, the first of two volumes in Carbon Ideologies, that the books were written as a single work, but your publisher, Viking, and I have to mention you also make a point of thanking them profusely for publishing the work, had other ideas. How'd you come to the decision with Viking to publish the work in two volumes, and what were the limitations?
Well, Viking said, you know, we're not going to do the book at the length that you want. And I said, okay, well, I'm really, really sorry that I'm going to have to return my advance and try to do it somewhere else.
After about 7 years of work.
Yeah. And they were kind of crabby and said, well, Bill, you know, you really better think about this. It's a pretty serious decision. So I thought about it and said, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. And then they said, well, then, all right, we'll do it your way. But, you know, we're going to publish it in two volumes. We're not going to put the notes in there. Those will have to be online.
And you almost always have notes and about your sources and other things in your other books. You mentioned Imperial has those, Dying Grass has those.
That's right. And I frankly thought and did think that it's unfortunate that the book is coming out in two volumes, that some of the material's gotten shuffled around. And if it were in one volume, it would be on nicer paper, so the illustrations would look better. But, you know, having complained and carped, I have to say that I am so grateful that they did it. They recognize the importance of this topic, and my poor colleagues just toiled and toiled away. We all got exhausted. They spent so much money on the copy editing. My designer stayed late. My senior production editor, Bruce, who's just an incredible man, would, you know, talk to his Japanese wife and say, well, Bill, are you sure this is the Japanese vegetable that you meant? Here's a photo of what it might be or might not be. I mean, they really went the extra mile, and you know, I'm not normally Mr. Grateful to corporations, but I have to say, yeah, I'm very grateful to Viking.
I have to mention in the acknowledgments, you thank all these people. You also thank the designer, and you tell her that you promise your next book will be shorter, and she just laughed.
Fortunately for Nancy, she has just been transferred to some different division, so she'll never have to work on my books again.
Oh, well, that's our loss. And Nancy's too, I think.
Well, you never know.
Now, Bill, you start the book with a primer section, and this goes into the cause and effect of greenhouse gases, so that's carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide, and an explanation of how all of us, you, me, everybody listening, are responsible for contributing to the crisis of climate change. This section contains a great deal of math and measurements, and you recognize the difficulty for the reader by calling the section uninviting, though, and I quote, useful in direct proportion to its dreariness.
Sounds about right.
Why start off with the primer then, rather than making an appendix at the back of the book, for example?
Because I want people to have some understanding of what causes climate change and how to do a cost-benefit analysis of the different kinds of fuels. In a way, you know, the primer is the most important part of the book. People don't have to read the rest of it if they don't want to, even though, like, the nuclear section is probably the most readable and interesting as a series of narrative journeys.
I would say the whole second volume is, too, about coal, oil, and natural gas.
Although a lot of that stuff is interviews as opposed to stories. You know, you don't actually feel the danger, and it doesn't look quite as strange as the nuclear zone. But anyway, it's nice of you to say so. And I'm thinking that we should all be trying to do this work. And what I did was just assemble a bunch of stuff and make some very simple calculations so that other people don't have to. And if someone were to ask you, well, all right, we're talking about building a new oil storage facility. Do you think we should do that or should we stick to coal? This book could help you think about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
In a way, it reminds me of your 7-volume series, Rising Up and Rising Down, where the question you considered was, when is violence warranted and when is it not?
That's right, yeah. And I originally thought I could have a very simple moral calculus, but it ended up being then as now that the result is more like a phone book. And it is sort of dreary. You have to say, well, really? You mean we have to think about, you know, the waste in producing sheet metal from liquid metal that then needs to be remelted, and we have to worry about, you know, sulfur hexafluoride, which has a very high global warming potential and is used in various crazy things like sports shoes and windows. Where do we get to the bottom of it? And, you know, one answer is that we're nickeling and diming our planet in so many different ways. Another thing to take away is that the so-called climate change deniers are not entirely wrong when they say that nature does affect the climate. You know, a lot of methane comes from termite mounds. Maybe as much as half of all the nitrous oxide is released naturally by the oceans and by the land. You know, but what I say to that is, then we have all the less room for error.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know a lot of climate deniers will say that the Earth goes through cycles of maybe higher greenhouse gases, and then it seems to recover on its own, and they say, don't worry. But you go into that later in the book, too,
yeah,
about that kind of attitude.
It's a little bit like, you know, the so-called two-Kuiper defense that the Nazis used at Nuremberg. They would say, well, yeah, all right, so the Soviets also committed mass atrocities. Therefore, you know, we shouldn't get hanged.
Right. Well, that didn't work out too well for them.
Not for them. Yeah.
Now, Bill, after the primer, Carbon Ideologies is pretty much divided into 4 main sections. And each of those sections corresponds to the 4 main types of energy sources. So there's nuclear, which you talked about. Then in the second volume, No Better Alternative, we have coal, natural gas, and oil. Some people have pointed out that the latter three are all causes of greenhouse gases, which of course contribute to climate change, but not nuclear. Why include and start off the 4 sections with nuclear?
Well, for 2 reasons. First of all, nuclear actually does require a fair amount of fossil fuels. The mining equipment, the trucks or other vehicles then used to transport the uranium, the enrichment facilities, and most importantly, the backup generators to keep the reactor fuel cool, which in fact failed at Fukushima, are all fossil fueled. So the irony is that we had these horrific nuclear explosions because we weren't getting enough carbon-based power. So let's not pretend that we don't need carbon, at least for now, until they figure out a way to have nuclear-powered trucks and all the rest of it. But the other reason is that nuclear is a very important carbon ideology. It's an ideology that says we can solve this global warming problem. And I often have people say, yeah, Bill, you know, you're not really being fair to nuclear. Yeah, it's caused these accidents, but what we need is a lot more money and we need to get prototypes in place that are safer. And if you give us the chance, we can really make a difference with global warming.
We've been hearing that for like 40, 50 years, though, with nuclear, haven't we? And there's still meltdowns. Well, Fukushima wasn't that long ago, 2011.
That's right. And they haven't figured out how to fix it. And it's not over. You know, it's still leaking strontium-90 and tritium into the Pacific Ocean today.
Now, we mentioned Fukushima, I should pronounce it. And I learned that from actually researching this interview. I keep saying Fukushima, but it's Fukushima. And the nuclear reactor melted down there after the earthquake and tsunami in 2011. Actually, there were three meltdowns, as you mentioned, because of the failure of the cooling systems.
That's right.
And you started visiting Fukushima in 2011, so directly after the meltdowns, three meltdowns?
That's right, yeah.
And you continued to visit that over the course of about 6 years while writing the book.
Yeah, my last visit was last January.
And in 2014, I think I read that you started bringing in instruments there to actually measure the radiation. And you had two, a dosimeter and a scintillation meter, which is also called a pancake frisker. Can you describe these instruments and how you use them?
Yes. I had the dosimeter from the very beginning. And although that was sold to me as something that I could do all kinds of neat things with, I could put it next to some food or some water and see whether it was radioactive. All that was sales baloney.
That's not true.
No, it's not true. All a dosimeter can do is measure your accrued dose. So
how much exposure you have over the course of a day or a week or something?
Or whatever, like yeah. Uh-huh. So you wear it on you, and then most dosimeters are only sensitive to gamma radiation. There's also alpha and beta. So there was a decontamination contractor at Fukushima named Buildup. And what they did was they got some lead sheets that were lying around near the reactor and instructed all their workers to cover their dosimeters with lead.
Wow. So a cover-up, literally.
Right. And that way, you know, the poor workers wouldn't be afraid when their dosimeters beeped, when the alarm went off. And, of course, the workers were busily getting toasted. It was really a very, very wicked, evil thing to do. But anyway, that's how those dosimeters were defeated. A scintillation counter, it's like the modern version of a Geiger counter, can often measure alpha, beta, and gamma, and it will tell you in real time how radioactive something is in front of you.
So, measured in sieverts, that's the unit?
Well, you can get it measured in lots of different units. They're calibrated to whatever, but a sievert is a typical modern unit of biological damage. I have an old friend, a retired radiologist, who said, you know, Bill, I'm too old to care about sieverts. You know, he's stuck with Rentkins. They're always changing the unit. But basically, one sievert will give you radiation sickness if you get it in a short period of time. A millisievert is a thousandth of a sievert, and they often refer to that in terms of annual dose. A microsievert is a millionth of a sievert. And here in Portland, you're going to get just a little bit more than a microsievert a day.
And you mentioned in the book that Portland is one of the least radioactive cities that you've measured.
I know, yeah. So congratulations, Portland.
Yeah. We're safe, I think,
that's
for the
right.
time being.
At least for now, yeah. So, you know, that works out to roughly, I don't know, say 0.06, 0.07 microsieverts per hour. Anything above 1 micro an hour is considered dangerous. So at Fukushima, I was measuring as much as 41.5 micros an hour, which would be about 700 times the minimum.
Oh, my. And you were exposed yourself then to that, too. Weren't you concerned about your own health? It's a silly question for me to ask you. I know you well enough that probably not.
I've reproduced, and, you know, maybe I would have reproduced again if I'd found any nice radioactive geishas. But strange to say, it was pretty empty there, those places.
Now, on your later trips to Fukushima, you write that the nuclear disaster is becoming normalized, just something that people have to live with and cope with. You ask a taxi driver in Fukushima Prefecture, you asked him, how do you feel about radiation? And he answered, since it's not close to here, it has no reality. If someone around here got cancer, I might feel something, but it's invisible, so I don't feel anything. And one more quote, too, from another resident there who said, even natural radiation exists, and if it's natural, it must be all right. I think it's safe to live in Iwaki, the town in Japan.
That's right.
There are nuclear plants all over the world. You can't flee anywhere.
That's right.
So that was your general impression, that most of the Japanese in the vicinity don't understand radiation and its effects or rationalizing it. I have to admit that was somewhat shocking to me, given that the first atomic bombs were dropped on Japan in World War II and resulted in extreme devastation. You'd figure they'd be more sensitive than anybody else in the world to
that. You would think so, but I met plenty of right-wingers who said, you know, Japan has got to get the atom bomb so we can drop it on China.
Oh, my.
That's human nature, right?
Right.
Yeah.
It happened to us, so we're going to do it to somebody else.
That's right. And, you know, the other thing is, just think of the ordinary course of human life. You know, Ken, you and I know that we're going to die. But deep down, we don't really believe it. Because
you're right.
Yeah, if we did, how miserable it would be, right? Uh-huh. We have to go on assuming that we're going to live and things will get better and better. So why wouldn't the Japanese do the same thing?
Right, it's funny because there's no more certain thing in the world than the fact that we're all going to die.
That's right.
Yeah, but to be sure.
At the same time, there's no immediate danger because we can't see it coming.
Well, that's the irony of the title of the first volume. You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with William T. Volman, author of the new 2-volume work, Carbon Ideologies. The first volume, titled No Immediate Danger, is now available, and the second volume, No Good Alternative, goes on sale June 5th. I'd like to touch a little, at least a little, Bill, on each section, so let's move on to coal, which starts off the second volume, No Good Alternative. You travel to both West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky, and you talk to coal miners and their families. You write that you started out very anti-coal. Obviously, it's dirty, unhealthy for the workers, contributes to climate change. But your sympathies, if not your opinion, changed a bit after talking with the residents of those coal towns?
Yes. And it seems to me that the biggest mistake that we people in the blue states can make now is not to reach out to the red state people. We're all in this together, and they feel that they have been ignored and looked down on by us for so long. I think we should say, you know what? You've done a great job of making my electricity work, and I want to thank you, and I think we should compensate you. That was the big mistake that Hillary made, I think, in just saying, oh, we're going to shut them all down. That's what they hear all the time. Why not say, we're going to help you, we're going to be grateful to you, and we're going to help you figure out how to make, you know, all American solar collectors with American flags on them, if that's what they want.
So in a way, they're hearing that we don't appreciate all they've contributed to the history of the U.S. and the progress, and that we just want to say, you know, no more coal, and your livelihoods are all gone.
That's right, yeah. A waitress once told me that in McDowell County, which is one of the poorest counties, you're either a coal miner, you're a prison guard, or you're in prison. So, and most people can't even be coal miners anymore. You know,
the jobs aren't there?
The jobs aren't there. And one of the lies that Big Coal tells is that it's all the fault of the socialist Obama or the wicked Clinton, you know, all this horrible environmental regulation. Well, that's some of it, but mostly it's because they've learned how to be more and more productive, more and more mechanized, with fewer and fewer people. And it's certainly a lot easier for them to say, oh, no, we wanted to keep all those jobs, but the wicked Democrats took
them
away.
They have a scapegoat, an easy scapegoat with the Democrats and when Hillary was running.
That's right.
And, Bill, you mentioned in that section a coal-related disaster in West Virginia, and one I don't remember reading about, but it was awful, Buffalo Creek flood of 1972. Can you tell us a little bit about that? What was the flood and what caused it?
Well, when they clean the coal, they end up with a lot of what's called coal slurry. And they break it down and take a whole bunch of particles and try to get the best of the stuff out. And then what's left is this nasty, dark, gluey stuff. They put it in dams to keep it out of the way. And so in 1972, at least one and maybe two of these dams failed. Went downstream, killed a bunch of people, made people homeless. And according to a retired mining inspector I talked to in Kentucky, they have these dams all over the place and they could fail at any time. There's one in West Virginia, very close to the site of that horrible Upper Big Branch disaster of 2010, where 29 guys were burned to death. And this dam, I'm told, is higher than Hoover Dam. And if it failed, it would send something like a 80 or 100-foot wall of this horrible stuff that would inundate the high school, you know, in a few minutes.
And that's a possibility still. They haven't done anything to mitigate that or prevent it.
That's right. And if anything, you know, they have prevented the inspection results from being released to the public. It's really just
another cover-up.
Yeah, quite despicable.
Now, there was one, at least for me, very memorable conversation you had with a longtime resident there, 89-year-old Glenna Wiley.
Oh, yeah.
She lived through that great flood, the Buffalo Creek flood of 1972. But she still says, and I quote, "I'm all for coal 100% because there are people living here that have given their young lives to coal 100%. Amen."
That's right.
"It's dirty, but it's powered our country forever so long." And that was not an uncommon point of view, I guess, in coal country in West Virginia. Huh?
No. And, you know, how do you drum up support for the Iraq War? You send over some soldiers, and then some of them get killed. Whether it's a good war or a bad war, then suddenly, now you have to support the troops.
And then you just hear, "support our troops," and any criticism is just, you respond with, "support our troops."
Right, don't be a traitor.
Right.
Yeah. So, all right, all these guys have died. You know, they say 100,000 coal miners were killed in the 20th century in the U.S. So, on the one hand, you could say, well, maybe we should make it safer. Maybe we should even do something different. Or on the other hand, you could say, how dare you, you know, belittle their sacrifice.
And that was manipulation coming from the coal companies and the executives. They made that choice not to make it safer, but to make it kind of an us versus them.
It's an easy thing to do. I'm not going to say they all do it on purpose, because I think the local people naturally feel that too. And I probably would, you know, if somebody killed somebody I loved, I'd be all about, hey, you know, I'm thinking about the person I lost, right or wrong.
Right.
But it's certainly to their advantage, you know, if they can keep people saying, yeah, we're soldiers of coal and the rest of the country doesn't appreciate us and we're going to fight for you against the Employment Prevention Agency.
The next section is on fracking and natural gas, and you visit Colorado, West Virginia again, and the United Arab Emirates. You mentioned that many people consider natural gas clean energy, I guess relative to coal or oil, it's clean carbon. But many residents of these areas feel differently. Can you tell us about your conversation with an activist in Loveland, Colorado, Sharon Carlisle? You write that her father worked in a uranium processing plant in Pennsylvania, and he died of cancer. You very ironically put in there, by some coincidence.
That's right. Yeah, she was very fired up, and she had really done her best to get an anti-fracking ordinance passed. She was a very, very committed political person. And I think the people who are in favor of fracking and don't believe in climate change would probably, you know, consider her very, very shrill and write her off. And I admired her energy. There was a lot of stuff she said that I really liked. I think my favorite part was, you know, her mother told her when she was a little girl that if the Russians or anyone else, you know, started dropping the nuclear missiles, then, you know, Sharon, you just need to walk straight into that light. You're not going to like it in the shelter, so just walk straight toward that glow and keep going.
Oh, I actually have the quote here, Bill. Yeah, because I loved it. So what she said, a continuation of fracking will seal your children's future and they will die a painful death.
Sounds like her.
You know we're going to go extinct and it's not going to be quick. Now, with global warming, people don't realize that it's going to be slow and painful, but the big boys must realize it. So why do they do it? You can't wrap your head around insanity, which is perfect. And I'm using that to lead us into the next section on oil, because you talked to one of those big boys who I don't think sounded very insane, but he was certainly defending the oil industry and natural gas, too. The man is Archie Dunham, and he's a retired CEO of Conoco, the oil company. You write that you visited this palatial estate overlooking the Pacific Ocean. He had all these art treasures, which he let you handle, a few of them you admired. It reminded me of the Xanadu scenes from Citizen Kane. You were let in on this, you know, Charles Foster Kane and his treasures. And you describe Dunham as a frank defender of oil, so you appreciated his frankness.
I really do.
Can you tell us a little about your talk with Mr. Dunham and his pro-oil arguments?
Well, one of the things he said was that if we were to act unilaterally to reduce our emissions, all that would happen would be that we would weaken our economies and benefit the economies of other countries.
Right, because if we stop producing some energy, maybe they'll start producing it in China or India.
Right, and I think that might be true. He also said that he could not believe that we had measured accurately, you know, sea levels going back over time, and he did not care to bankrupt the U.S. economy, you know, to prevent, you know, a couple sheets of paper worth of sea level rise. He was very suspicious of that, and I have to say, that's one of the tragedies in this situation, that it's a normal human being kind of virtue to be able to look around you and make your own decisions based on your own senses and your own experience. And that's what he was doing. And
he was, in addition to being CEO of Conoco, he was a geological engineer too, his background.
That's right.
So he had some scientific training.
That's right. And so I was just so happy that he was willing to go on the record and talk about what he believed, because mostly, you know, these people like the Heartland Institute or all the politicians in West Virginia would not even return a phone call. The refrigerator manufacturers, one actually got back to my assistant just to say, you know, declined to participate. So
it was hard for you to get the other view, the pro-oil, the pro-coal. Well, certainly from these executives.
Right, or even just from the PR people. Mm-hmm. That was another thing that I really liked about TEPCO. I mean, they sure created a horrible mess, but at least
in Fukushima, right?
Yeah, they had a whole bunch of PR people actually willing to meet me and answer my written questions. It's hard to imagine Noble Energy in Colorado doing that for me. You know, they wouldn't even answer me when I said, hey, you know, what's your case for fracking?
Oh, I had a request, Bill, just to give listeners kind of a taste of your writing here, if they're not familiar with the Volman style. And actually, it's different in every book. So,
I'll do my best.
So there's no familiarity there. No Good Alternative, you tell this great story about being back at home in Sacramento and you're going out with your daughter who's visiting from college. She's away at college, and you go out for ice cream. I wonder if you can kind of set this up and then read the passage for us. So maybe a little bit about your trip with your daughter and what you were thinking, and then how this led to what we're going to read here.
Well, Ken, when I was in the Emirates, I had a chance to have a rose milkshake, and I just loved it. I'd never had one before. And so when I got back, I thought, oh, it'd be so much fun, you know, to make something like that with Lisa. And I miss her, you know, she's a big girl now away at college, and it seems like sort of an innocent thing to do.
A dad taking his daughter out for ice cream.
Yeah, that's
What's
right.
What's more American?
That's right. My dad used to have a job working as a soda jerk, as they called it then. And the rule was that he could make whatever he wanted as long as he finished it.
And, that's a good rule to live by.
And the one mistake he made, he once made an orange milkshake. And he said it was so terrible, he had to drink it. He still remembered it, you know, to the day of his death. So anyway, I decided I would, you know, have this rose milkshake or a substitute with Lisa. And then I started thinking, okay, now I guess we'd better consider the costs in energy. So that's what this passage is about. When I think of you in the future reading this, my error is to imagine that you are similar to me. Being nurtured and pampered by electric power, I owned full leisure to emote, consider your point of view, and even feel goodwill toward you. I wish to understand you and to help you understand me, as if that could somehow distract, console, or at least enlighten you about the hot, dark world in which you dwell. If you could end up saying, well, yes, we might have made the same mistakes as you if we'd been lucky enough to live when you did, I'd feel that carbon ideologies had accomplished some of its purpose. How you judge us can mean nothing to us who are dead. But to you, it might mean something to accept that we were not all monsters, and forgiveness benefits the forgiver. So why wouldn't I prefer you to call our doings mistakes instead of crimes? But weary common sense and my own experience in war zones and other desperate places drags down these narcissistic expectations. Most likely, you are a hard, angry person. By my standard, you must be somewhat uneducated, since we expended most of the magic that would have kept your lights on. How well can you read? For that matter, how well can you see? Do spectacles still exist? Beset by floods, droughts, diseases, and insect plagues, unable to jet around the world as I did, but probably aware nonetheless that humanity's habitable islands keep shrinking, engaged in wars about food and united merely in tribal hatred, your strongman against theirs, radiation tainted, fearing for your children in the face of multiplying perils, how can you feel anything better than impatient contempt for my daughter and me, who lived so wastefully for our own pleasure?
Oh, thanks, Bill.
Oh, sure.
That sounds like some science fiction apocalypse, but
maybe here we are.
An all too probable future, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Of course, that's the point of view of the book. You're talking to that future reader, as we mentioned.
But the good news, Ken, is that you and I are already safely dead. We don't have to worry.
Yeah, I've never felt so good about being dead. Bill, your reporting on climate change and carbon ideologies is just amazing. It's beyond extensive. You went to such lengths, and the conclusions you reach are not optimistic ones, as we saw from that. Do you have any cause for hope, or is the human species, among others, pretty much doomed?
Well, in the solar chapter, you know, I discovered when I hired a solar expert at Georgia Tech to read it that it's possible to really, really reduce emissions drastically. That if we had a solar reserve about the same area as North Korea, not that I want Mr. Trump to be thinking about that, we could supply maybe all of the power for the entire world. That's assuming somehow that we could make airplanes battery-powered or whatever. The bad news is, as I learned from a guy at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, that if we were to desist from all of our carbon emissions today.
That's what I was going to ask you. Is it too late?
Then for at least the next 2,000 years, carbon dioxide would continue to warm 8 times more than in the first 100, and probably for 7,000 to 8,000 years, the climate would still be warming, the oceans would still be rising and acidifying. So that's not a very good picture.
So even if we were to find some kind of miracle energy source at this point, 100% efficient solar, it might be too late.
It might be. On the other hand, maybe we could figure out some better way to sequester carbon. You know, if we get desperate and we really, you know, engage in some kind of mega Marshall Plan, then maybe we could come up with something. But it's all ifs. You know, the unremediated effect of CO2 is pretty certain. And right now we're sort of grasping at straws.
I was hoping to leave on an optimistic note, so I'll ask about something that you can control. And I know you're always working on several projects at the same time. I read that you actually have a finished novel at Viking right now, but they're not quite ready to publish it.
Yeah, well, you said you wanted to end on an optimistic note, and that's very gloomy novel.
Okay. Well, there's two other novels that you're working on, right?
That's right.
One you're researching, I think you went up to Seattle to research, called The Lesbian Working Title.
That's right, yeah.
And then another one, I read it was a gonzo thriller that takes place on the Sacramento River Delta about the rogue son of a CIA agent.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, that's part of it. Yeah.
So that's somewhat optimistic, right? You're still writing these wonderful books. I'll take that away.
That sounds good. Yeah, I do my best.
And I know I asked this last time, and you probably get asked a lot. You finished 5 books of the 7 Dreams. You're so close to completing the series, and you even told me what you had in mind for book 4 and 6, or the two remaining ones. Do you have any estimate on that? I think at one time you said, if I live another 10, 15 years, I'll finish them. So
that sounds about right.
You're in no hurry.
That's right. These next two novels I want to come first. And I think it's a good idea to have a lot of space between these 7 Dreams novels because, you know, they need to be told in different voices.
Yeah, you definitely do that.
So it'd be awful if, you know, one of them sounded like another one.
Yeah, there are different periods and there are different peoples that you're describing.
That's right, yeah.
Well, Bill Volman, again, thanks very much. It's always a joy for me to talk with you, and especially at KABU and on Between the Covers.
Well, it's great to hang out with you, Ken.
And we'll see you tonight at Powell's.
Okay, I hope so.
We've been talking with William T. Volman, author of the new 2-volume work, Carbon Ideologies. The first volume, titled No Immediate Danger, is now available. And the second volume, No Good Alternative, goes on sale June 5th. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KABU Community Radio. Many thanks to Bill for visiting us at KABU, and to all of you for listening.
Now there is no more morning dew. No.